content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hi, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. We'll start today with Boredom is the Price We Pay for Meaning by Daniel Smith. This is an essay excerpted from Daniel Smith's forthcoming book, Hard Feelings, Finding the Wisdom in Our Darkest Emotions. When my first child was born, I discovered, as many parents do, that my love for her was more profound than I could have anticipated. I had friends and relatives for whom I was willing to die. For my daughter, so visceral was my love, so instantaneous and complete, I knew I would kill. That I loved my daughter was never in doubt. My problem was that I didn't much like being a father. This came as a shock. I'd wanted a baby because I had taken such pleasure in life that I felt driven to expand the scope of existence itself. Experience was too wonderful to hoard, so I had a child. The irony was painful in that, seemingly overnight, the very things that most enlivened and sustained me, reading, watching movies, seeing friends, making love, sitting quietly by myself, were crowded out by a child whose needs absorbed nearly all of my energy and time. From a life of freedom and agency, I had entered a life of constriction and tension, of white noise machines, parenting manuals, and fatigue. No one had warned me, or had they? At 4 a.m. one morning, between shifts of bouncing my colicky daughter, a line from the writer Nora Johnson returned to me. Being a parent, Johnson insisted, isn't about nobility or beauty, pride or pleasure. Rather, it's the simple, nerve-wracking, mindless, battering ram process of trying to teach a savage to use a fork. I remember this line the way Julius Caesar, his blood pooling on the senatorial marble, must have remembered, "Beware the Ides of March." My love for my child remained fierce. When she giggled, her throat pulsed like a bullfrog's. On the street, strangers beamed at her round cheeks and blue eyes, and at me, happily implicated in her freshness. What a doting father! Look at him carrying his baby to the park, to the market, to the playground, tying a bonnet to her head, slathering her pink plump arms with organic sunblock. I cherished the vigilant and protective forces that radiated inside me. But all of this rapturous gazing made up a terribly small fraction of the experience of being a parent. Much of the rest, as the months and years passed, consisted of nothing more than blunt, basic, run-of-the-mill boredom. The boredom of playgrounds, the boredom of picture books, the boredom of Cheerios, pasta, peanut butter, and goldfish. The boredom, distilled and perfect, of the demand, again, do it again, Daddy, say it again, play it again, 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 again. With certain intimates, I could confess just how monotonous I found parenting to be. With other people, these disclosures would have been like admitting to drowning kittens or robbing liquor stores. Children, that great adventure, boring. The care and feeding of a human soul, tedious. I came to see my parental dispossession as, at best, anachronistic and, at worst, deficient. I tried to pretend that I didn't find the whole business alienatingly dull. When my daughter was six, her mother and I split up. That our divorce, though managed with comparative civility, caused our daughter abiding pain, hardened my resolve to cap my output at one. I began to dream longingly of a future time when my daughter was grown and I could return without undue guilt or strain to my own needs. Then I fell in love again. My new partner longed for children and I longed to make her happy, which scrambled my sense of self-interest. Now, alongside my eldest daughter, who is 18, I have a young son and daughter, and so I am racked once again with that same militant love and that same depleting boredom. And I am haunted once again by that old feeling of deficiency, by the belief that boredom, in this vital intimate context, is wrong and ought to be suppressed. But I know that it can't be. The effort to stifle a hard emotion almost always fails, and it causes it to fester and breed. The only way to endure boredom, like anger, despair, shame, is to move toward it, to listen to it, to try to understand it. Recently, I overheard a woman tell her son on the playground, "Don't say, 'I'm bored.' Bored is a bad word." I, too, was raised to hold boredom in contempt. In emotional terms, my childhood home was like the set of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. You could confess to any painful feeling whatsoever and be met with empathy, curiosity, and concern. Every feeling, that is, except boredom, which was simply and firmly rejected. To be bored was to suffer from a self-imposed blindness to the wonders of life. My parents had plenty of help conveying this to me. Nearly every children's book in our house trumpeted the same anti-boredom propaganda. How can you be bored when you can create so much with only a purple crayon? When boredom does occur in children's books, it's a fleeting state. The stillness before the explosion. Bang! The white rabbit dives down the hall. Blang, bang, the manic cat bursts through the door. What these books capture so beautifully is the great luxury of time that children possess. A children's boredom is usually a whine that there is nothing to do. I'm bored. This explains why parents have so little patience for the complaint. Bored? When you are on hold with the insurance company? When you are emptying the dishwasher, wiping down the counter, fielding messages from colleagues, clients, your boss, your ex, your mother, the school, the bank, a confession of boredom from anyone, but especially from the primary beneficiary of your efforts, can feel like an insult. You're bored. You want something to do? Go clean your room. Go dust the sconces. Take out the garbage. Go count squirrels for all I care. Dinner's in 20 minutes. Sometimes we cling to our negative emotions for what they give us, a vigor of agitation, the punishment we deserve. A friend once told me that when she was going through her divorce, she deliberately stoked her anger in order to fight more effectively with her husband and his lawyer. Boredom isn't like this. Boredom is almost purely aversive. We yearn for it to end. This makes boredom a potentially dangerous emotion, and sufferers may grasp at anything for relief. A 2009 USAID report on the causes of violent extremism concluded, "It is difficult to overestimate the extent to which boredom significantly enhances youth vulnerability to extremist ideas and activities." In a 2014 study published in the journal Science, participants left alone in a room for 15 minutes grew so bored with their own quiet thinking that they willingly gave themselves electric shocks just to feel something. "Boredom is the root of all evil," declares a character in Kierkegaard's Either Or. But boredom needn't be destructive. The discomfort of boredom, even the anguish of it, can spur us into flights of imagination, resourcefulness, and invention. It can prod us to seek more absorbing circumstances, a career more aligned with our interests, a partner more aligned with our needs, a livelier town, better hobbies, new forms of beauty and inspiration. And yet I can't remember a time when my own boredom encouraged a more profound engagement, a more vibrant creativity. My boredom typically spurs feelings of frustration, guilt, shame, and long, nutritionless spells of goggling, slack-jawed at celebrity news on my phone while the world throbs around me. For me, boredom is a destabilizing state that affects the very experiences that make life meaningful. In 1989 at Dartmouth College, the poet and essayist Joseph Brodsky delivered what must be one of the strangest commencement addresses of all times. Brodsky told the graduates that their lives would soon be claimed by the, quote, incurable malaise, end quote, of boredom. If they thought they already knew this feeling, they were wrong. The worst monotonous drone coming from a lectern or the eye-splitting textbook Intergent English is nothing in comparison to the psychological Sahara that starts right in your bedroom and spurns the horizon. Some may try to keep this feeling at bay, Brodsky explained, by changing jobs, houses, careers, or lovers, by embracing hobbies, travel, or promiscuity. Eventually, though, boredom would get them all. Brodsky advised his listeners to give up trying to evade the feeling and start respecting it. Boredom exists to teach you the most valuable lesson in your life, he said, the lesson of your utter insignificance. Boredom puts us in our tiny, fragile, finite place. And thank goodness for that, for the more finite a thing is, the more it is charged with life, with love, pain, excitement, and fear. If you try to distract yourself from boredom, if you run from it, all will be lost. Brodsky quoted an imperishable line from Robert Frost. The best way out is always through. A note written by the novelist David Foster Wallace makes a similar point. Bliss, a second-by-second joy and gratitude at the gift of being alive, conscious, lies on the other side of crushing, crushing boredom. I don't think we need the promise of bliss to endure and learn from boredom. Enlightenment is welcome should it come, but awareness, mere awareness, a calm and loving truce with reality, is the more realistic goal. Sunday morning, winter. I write for a couple of hours at my desk. The work is slow, as usual. I am going over my notes, hoping to find something for my brain to latch on to. Soon enough, it's time to watch the kids. I enter the kitchen wearing what my wife calls my, quote, haunted, end quote, look. Not a great morning, she asks. I shrug. I am practicing being stoic. The floor is littered with markers, crayons, and sheets of paper. The children are... What are the children? Ceaseless. They are desperate to be seen. Look, Daddy, look, Daddy. Daddy, look. How nice. What a nice sticker. Well done, sweetheart. Look, Daddy, 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 look. Yes, I saw. Very nice. The four-year-old is in a questioning phase. Are penguins cold? Are lions scary? Is tea hot? What is air? I refill sippy cups. I police conflicts. I toast toast. Have I ever been so bored? We've got errands to run. It takes the boy 7 minutes to put on his Velcro sneakers and another 2 to zip up his jacket, which he insists he must do by himself. We need carrots, broccoli, bread, milk, cheese, tampons. The day and my mind start to loosen. The thin light of some minor pleasure starts to glow. Is it nostalgia? It the memory of shopping with my own father? Let it in, I tell myself. The boy loves the grocery store, the colors, the smells, the possibilities. I have shopped for food 1 million times at 1 million stores. His hand is so warm. The sun is going down. I notice the boy shivering and ask if he would like some hot chocolate. We find a small table outside the deli and sit across from each other. The hot chocolate is too hot to drink, but he wants to see the steam rise, to tell me that steam is different from smoke. The tip of his nose and the tips of his fingers are red. When at last he drinks, the hot chocolate coats his upper lip. He smiles. Everything that displays a pattern is pregnant with boredom, Brodsky told those flabbergasted undergrads. Of course, much of what displays a pattern, lifelong friendships, enduring marriages, serious scholarship, the making of art, prayer, Sunday mornings in winter, is also pregnant with meaning. Boredom is the price we pay for a life rich with meaning. Recognizing this makes the feeling more endurable. Meaning and boredom, boredom and meeting, hand in hand. Our second story, Anthropic's ethical stand could be paying off. This was written by Ken Harbaugh. At first glance, the week looked like a catastrophe for Anthropic. The AI company refused to let the U.S. government use its products to surveil the American public or direct autonomous weapons without human oversight. In response, the Department of Defense canceled its $200 million contract. On Truth Social, President Trump called the company, quote, left-wing nut jobs, end quote, and ordered every federal agency to immediately stop using its products. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth went a step further, designating Anthropic as a supply chain risk to national security. OpenAI, Anthropic's chief rival, quickly signed its own deal with the Pentagon. Anthropic's principled stand continues to pose enormous risks for the company, but some early indications suggest that it just might pay off. The company's confrontation with the Department of Defense has proved more effective than some of the world's most expensive advertising, at least according to one metric. After a Super Bowl campaign earlier this year, Anthropic's AI model, called Claude, became one of the top 10 most downloaded free apps in America, per Apple's charts. The day after Hegseth announced that the government was severing ties, it took the number one spot, a position it still holds, as of this writing. Downloads have dropped 1 million a day, according to Anthropic's chief product officer. A spokesperson told me that the company has broken its own sign-up record every day since early last week, across every country where Claude is available. Users aren't just signing up for Claude, they are also abandoning OpenAI, which has a corporate partnership with The Atlantic magazine. Uninstalls of ChatGPT, OpenAI's flagship app, spiked 295% on February 28th as details of OpenAI's deal with the Pentagon emerged. One-star reviews surged nearly 800%, and five-star reviews fell by half. Perhaps more consequential, Anthropic has gained the trust and admiration of engineers across the AI industry. Letters of support for the company are circulating among its competitors' employees. One such letter had some 850 signatures as of Monday. Many of these employees are demanding that their company show solidarity with Anthropic and honor the same red lines. Some have reportedly threatened to leave if those demands are not met. Anthropic has won admiration outside Silicon Valley, too. Before the company's clash with the Department of Defense, former Republican Representative Denver Riggleman, who now leads a cybersecurity firm, was preparing to pick an AI firm to partner with. He was considering a range of options. Anthropic's stand narrowed them to one. Riggleman has since directed his company to work with Anthropic on all future projects. Anthropic had its non-negotiables, he told me, and we have ours. Drawing from his experience on a congressional AI task force focused on foreign adversaries, Riggleman thinks that Hegseth's decision to label Anthropic a supply chain risk will likely be overturned in court. The U.S. government has never applied the label to an American company, typically reserving it for corporations run by hostile former actors such as Huawei. Moreover, this is the first time that the label appears to have been used in retaliation for a business declining contract terms. To say that it rests on shaky legal ground, Riggleman said, would be generous. The former congressman once trusted his country to regulate technologies that had the power to reshape Americans' lives. These days, Riggleman said, the government is no longer creating those safeguards. It's destroying them. He continued, I don't think we appreciate yet as a society what it means to have private firms controlling this amount of information about citizens. The Department of Defense has said that the contract it offered Anthropic contained adequate safeguards, in part because the text limited AI's uses to, quote, all lawful purposes, end quote. Anthropic argued that this clause wasn't sufficient, that a new executive order or reinterpretation of statute could shift the existing legal boundaries. We don't want to sell something, Anthropic CEO Dario Amodei said, that could get our own people killed, or that could get innocent people killed. OpenAI has contended that its subsequent deal with the Pentagon is safer than Anthropic's. Its contract does not appear to prohibit mass surveillance and autonomous weapons, but it retains the all lawful purposes language, rendering that prohibition dependent on the Department of Defense's willingness to respect legal norms. Even Sam Altman, OpenAI CEO, conceded that the deal was definitely rushed and the optics don't look good. The company said that it had added restrictions to the contract regarding surveillance, but critics are skeptical that they will prove any more binding. The events of this past week reminded me of my early days as a Navy pilot nearly three decades ago. One of my first tasks was to sign a document pledging never to surveil American citizens. By the time of the 9/11 attacks, I was an aircraft commander, leading combat reconnaissance air crews that gathered large-scale intelligence and informed battlefield targeting decisions. I took for granted that somewhere along those decision chains, a human being was in the loop. I could not have defined artificial intelligence then, but I understood instinctively that a person, not a machine, would bear the weight of life and death choices. This is not a bureaucratic consideration. It was a hard line that those of us in uniform were expected to hold. In the standoff between Anthropic and the Pentagon, a private company was forced to hold the line against its own government. In doing so, Anthropic may have earned something more valuable than the contract it lost. In an industry where trust is the scarcest resource, Anthropic just banked a substantial deposit. Next, Why Dinner Never Gets Easier, by Rafaela Jinnish. Of the many problems modern life has promised to solve, dinner remains a stubborn nuisance. Not the eating of it exactly, but the endless planning for it. The recipe hunting, the shopping, the post-work reckoning of what is or isn't in the fridge. An entire industry made up of meal prep companies, delivery food apps, and grocery store frozen entrees is devoted to this nightly question. Dinner has been vexing people for a very long time. Read the writing by women expected to run their household's kitchen, and you can see how this sphere of domesticity has long doubled as a window into the shifting concerns of daily life. In 1932, Helen Keller published an Atlantic essay, Put Your Husband in the Kitchen, and opened with the intricate ritual of making a Christmas fruitcake. The scene is dense with logistics. Nuts to crack, oranges and lemons to peel, a stove fire to maintain with the utmost precision. Family members are instructed to walk softly so the batter won't fall. As she describes this carefully managed procedure, Keller notes that it is already becoming a lost art. New technologies were expediting even the simplest tasks. Electricity, pre-prepared ingredients, and advancements in home appliances had transformed household labor. The modern housewife could now call the grocer to place an order because more households were installing telephones. The machine age has come upon us, transforming the home no less surely than the factory, Keller wrote. Keller understood the changes to domestic work revealed something larger about the economy and people's broader anxieties outside the home. As the century progressed, the strain in the kitchen took on a different character. By the late 20th century, women were entering the workforce in large numbers. In the Atlantic's September 1986 issue, George Gilder observed that the drastic shifts in sex roles seems to be sweeping through America. From 1890 to 1985, labor force participation of women ages 25 to 44 rose from 15 to 71%, a revolution that upended the calculus of family meals. By the late 2010s, the technological transformation that Keller described had largely come to pass. The fruitcake didn't need to be baked. It could be dropped off by an Uber Eats courier. The grocery store was always open. Dinner, in theory, should have been easier than ever, but the pressure around it hadn't disappeared. Writing in 2019, Amanda Mall described the familiar sight of meal kit boxes, Blue Apron, Hello Fresh, sitting abandoned and slightly stinky in apartment buildings. These services promised to streamline the nightly meal. Perfect portions, no menu planning, restaurant-style cooking at home. Instead, they kept colliding with the same constraint, time. From February 2018 to February 2019, 45% of American meals were eaten alone, Mall wrote. No matter how many meal kits and fast dinner solutions were being peddled to consumers, the structure of American life had shifted in ways that made a traditional dinner routine harder to sustain. Dual-income households had become common. Commutes had lengthened due to urban sprawl and more traffic congestion. A quiet monologue runs through my head at all times. It is this: dinner, 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 dinner. Rachel Sugar wrote last January, "The dinner problem might be especially acute for working parents. Children are unrelenting in their demand to eat at regular intervals, but it spares almost no one." If logistical innovation alone could have solved dinner, it would have been solved several times over. Even in what Sugar calls the world historic peak of dinner solutions, the meal remains unrelenting in the way that that breathing is unrelenting. Meals can now be reheated in minutes. The groceries may arrive in a box, and the onions may come pre-chopped. But the constant decision-making, what to prepare, when to eat it, hasn't gone anywhere. What happens in the kitchen has never been just about the food. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Please join us next time. We hope that you have enjoyed listening. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.